Hello and welcome to the Feeder Series podcast. I'm your host, Jim Kimberley. And let me say good day or good night or whatever time it is, because there's been a lot of races, a lot of strange times, although I know one of our pundits here sleeps on a very different time schedule from everybody else, so maybe they'll be the most coherent of us. But to three people joining me to talk all things Australia, plus a little bit of Spain and Japan, of all places. More on that to come. We'll tease that for now, but you'll understand in a second, because I have one of two Feeder Series F2 editors with me, Martin Lloyd. And I have to also say, somebody's not here, a huge shout out to Stephen Walton, our other F2 editor, who was on the ground in Melbourne and did a stellar job. We're going to talk a little bit about what a stellar job he did immediately with the first bit of work. I don't know what you would call it, but again, I'll come on to that in a second. Also, returning to the podcast is our ex-F3 editor and current head of copy editing. Is that right? Michael McClure? Head of copy editing? Correct.
Nightmare sleep schedules.
And that's it. That's a good connection. The person who sleeps anytime. Is it 22 hours you did on Saturday?
Yeah, about something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's really screwed us all up. And I have to also say, finally, let me welcome a new voice, new face, if you're watching, to the show, Finjo Mushlin. Did I say it right, Finjo?
Yes, you did. Well done, mate.
Thank you very much.
And yeah, thanks for having me on.
No, well, I need to get your job title out, and maybe people can understand where the Japan and Spain links come from, because you have the very short job title of Super Formula, Super Formula Lights, Formula Regional Japan, Japanese F4, and Formula Winter Series Editor, which just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of funny, isn't it? Like, yeah, it's also two different parts of the Earth, so it's kind of funny.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to actually catch up a little bit, because obviously Super Formula kicked off. I actually going to tease a bit of Teo Porcher, who people who follow us on social media might know, that we had a podcast with him, which I recorded about a week or so ago. And I think that's going to be the next one that gets released, so look forward to that. He's despite everything, which Finjo's going to explain, I imagine, he was in good spirits. We love Teo. He's a lovely chap, and missing him in F2, but of course the champion can't come back, and we're looking to get a new champion. And well, let me go professionally and say that new champion might be a Campos driver. And let's follow on from something we spoke about recently. Campos are all of a sudden, I admit that's unfair, but they've certainly ascended to one of the top feeder series teams in F2 and F3 at the moment, and consistently doing well from midfield backmarker obscurity a few years ago. So, well, when you take it away, it's been a hell of a weekend in the feeder series world, and there's a lot to talk about. Where do you want to start, Martin? And let's go from there.
I'll start with the F2 sprint race. And I want to start with something that involved both Campos drivers. Basically, as soon as we got underway, it had just gone midnight on Saturday morning where I am. It was a very long day, so I'm trying to keep my eyes open. And then my eyes were very well kept open, because there was quite a large accident that happened when Isaac Hadjar and Josep Maria Martí and Gabriel Bortoleto came together. And Hadjar went on to win that race, but then got a 10-second penalty later on, as he was judged to have come across and started that incident. And I think the level of the penalty is debatable, and I think that's probably something that we'll come on to later on a broader theme.
I think,
yeah. And that was something across, F2, F3 and F1 that all competed at Albert Park. And I think it was an interesting weekend for the stewards, but certainly that penalty for Hadjar and a couple of issues for Martí being the blemishes on Campos's F2 record this weekend. But I think it was a really impressive weekend for them. It was something that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. I think it was after the Bahrain episode, because Campos were really strong there. Isaac Hadjar qualifying in the top three, Pepe Marte with the podiums. And we were thinking, can Campos continue this form? Because certainly this has happened in previous years. Certainly last year, Campos scored 42% of all their points in Bahrain. We were thinking, can they continue that form? But it looks like they can, because in Australia, they were really, really strong. Isaac Hadjar could have had a double win had it not been for that penalty. So I think Campos is my overriding takeaway from this weekend, that they are definitely a force to be reckoned with, and not people to think about as if they were a force which maybe with a lesser force from the last couple of years.
Let me throw from that, and it's a round of applause. Hajar, a bit fortunate on the feature race, it's inarguable, but it's one of those poetic type things. And I say a bit fortunate just with timings of weird timings of virtual safety cars, and so on. And I hate to always focus or feel like I'm always focusing on them, but we expected Prema to do well. But I feel like I have to talk about Prema because they've got an F1 driver racing for them now who has 2 points in Formula 2. And that's almost by virtue of a post-race disqualification as well for Franco Colapinto. Heartbreaking. Franco, so sometimes the luck, and especially in Australia, doesn't seem to go his way, bless him. So it's been a funny old time. And Herman, is he cracking under? I mean, it's way early to say, and I hate to say, but is he going to crack under pressure now? Like the whole composition of this season, Martin, is changing for him. A spin by himself, and then P14, poor qualification. It's starting to unravel already. It feels like
it was a difficult weekend for Behrmann, and I found it quite interesting. And it's something that I alluded to in my post weekend piece that should be coming out soon. That Prema seemed to have made a step forward with Antonelli, but it's taking a little while, certainly this weekend, for Behrmann to reach the top fives that Antonelli was competing for. Behrmann, of course, did get pole in Saudi, so it's not like he's had a totally awful season, although, of course, he didn't actually get the points, but that's another matter. I think certainly rhythm is something to talk about when you've come down from the high of being, you know, a Ferrari F1 driver and scoring points, and then suddenly you're back down to earth doing the day job in Prema, trying to win that Formula 2 championship. I think there is something to be said that maybe he was still adjusting to that, although it had been a couple of weeks. I think there was an adjustment period, but certainly I was quite surprised with how difficult a weekend he'd had, especially considering Antonelli's pace. Antonelli, who was fighting for the win with Hauger in the very early stages and didn't get a podium in the end, but certainly looked like challenging for one before Aaron and Maloney came along. I think it was a really interesting weekend for Prema. It's not a long-term thing, I don't think, for Behrmann. I would be really surprised if, when the season doesn't kick on in Europe, he won't start to push on and get better results and get back to those top fives that we know he can regularly get. But certainly this weekend, it was quite a surprise to see him and a couple of other drivers struggling who would have maybe thought could have kicked on by this point.
It's an interesting championship as ever. We will come back onto it as well. And I always feel bad because I overlooked Hauger because of the mess, let's call it, in the feature race. But that was ending a run of 3 podiums in a row, coming from Jeddah and now here. So the championship as it stands, Zane Maloney, who seems to have really found a rhythm with this car, is sitting P1 with 62 points. Paul Aron, who, I mean, as rookies go in the championship, I didn't expect Paul to be up there, and congratulations to him. Looks muscles out and doing a cracking job. 47 points, P2. Dennis Hauger, P3 with 41 points. It's not the championship order that I expected. Somewhat segueing into what we've got with F3, which is not necessarily going to plan, I'd say, but there is a bit more. This is going to be a segue to you, Michael, so get ready for this. But it's more of a established order that we've got Luke Browning, Leo Fornaroli, Gabriel Mini, Dino Boganovic, and then some chap called Arvid Lindblad, who just seems to love sprint races at the top. But him, Tim Chamnitz, doing an exceptional job. But those three drivers that we saw heading the feature race, Boganovic with his first win, which, as the group chat in feeder series know on our little WhatsApp group we've got, I had no idea he hadn't won in F3, which blew my little mind. I just assumed it's Dino Boganovic. Of course he's won a race, but no. Fornaroli and Gabriele Mini, and then Luke Browning in P4. To me, Michael, these are potentially going to be the championship protagonists. Am I potentially wrong?
I'd say you're right. I think coming into the season, you know, even if we look back at Macau in November, the three drivers that, you know, regularly were up there, we had Browning, we had Mini, and we had Boganovic. Obviously, Alex Dunn had a star turn there as well. A few other drivers, Mary Boyd, performed particularly well. That was in a different car. I think we can see those three have got that experience. Leo Fornaroli is an interesting driver because he comes from a background of being very, very consistent, but not actually showing race-winning pace a lot of the time. I mean, he was up there, got podiums last year, and his Freca campaign, he didn't take a single podium, I believe. He's only got 2 wins in cars, which is astounding to me, considering the qualifying pace. Yeah. One in Italian F4 in 2021, another one in F4 Central European Zone. There was a round when a bunch of the ADEC and Italian drivers went to that series, which is otherwise, you know, fairly lower in level. So Fornaroli's now in, you know, a car that we saw last year. It's not Bortoletto's chassis, but we've seen what he can do with that. I think his thing is going to have to get over is be up there at the front and win. Yesterday, you know, he led the race for a good part of it. He didn't end up taking that final step. Dino did. So Fornaroli really has to convert that in the end. He's got the pace, I think perhaps even more raw pace than Dino, as we saw in qualifying, but there's still that extra gap he's got to go over. For Vganovic, I think it was a crucial weekend. You know, we saw the relief at the end of the race. He's a driver with a lot of bad luck in the first round. You know, that clutch issue didn't get off the line properly. And so Browning was able to romp away to the win. But Dino is also someone who's, you know, a bit spiky in form. His 2021 Freca campaign was not the best. Wasn't, you know, could have been a lot farther up, but he ended up something like 13th or 14th. Granted, as a rookie, then second year, he comes in and blitzes the field immediately and then, you know, falls back a bit later. So he's going to really have to capitalize on this momentum he's got. It's a shame for him there's no racing for a couple of months. I think also, you know, we can't overlook the impact of when we've got testing presumably coming up as well. I don't believe it's been announced yet, but F3 should have some form of in-season testing as well. And that's going to be a really crucial opportunity for the drivers to, you know, take the lesson they've got from these first 2 rounds, which, while maybe more normal in the order we've got, are still not necessarily representative of what we have later. Bahrain's always anomalous because of the way that tires behave. Australia is obviously more of a street circuit. And so, you know, heading into those traditional tracks we've got later, like Imola, Catalunya, Spielberg, Hungaroring, etc., this testing period is going to be really crucial for them to hone in on it. And for drivers who've, you know, been up there, but not necessarily in that top group, drivers like Oliver Goethe last year was at Trident. You know, he's up there with Campos, but he's not quite in that top tier. Mari Boyer, you could say the same thing about. Christian Mansell had a great time in Bahrain, not quite as far up in Australia. For them as well, they're going to really need this period to decide, you know, can they actually be in the group with this top 4 we've got right now? Or are they going to be kind of in this upper midfield on the periphery, able to luck into a couple of wins, take sprint wins, but, you know, not necessarily dominate a feature race, as we've seen the first 4, you know, especially the likes of Browning and Vganovic can for sure do.
Yeah, it's we love F3. I've said it multiple times, and no disrespect to anybody else, any other drivers, but F3 is just barnstorming every single time. I mean, it's official. It's got to be official by now at this point. And Finn, I'll let you speak on this side of things, because I'm not just going to leave you to the end with your championships. That Melbourne and Feeder Series is a match made in heaven. How much did you enjoy the racing we had this weekend? And any takeaways from you that you want to bring up, Finya?
I loved it. I got to admit, I overslept the F2 races, both of them. But, you know, I obviously caught up with the highlights. But the F3 races were really entertaining. I mean, I obviously focused on Tim Tramnitz a little. And just to see, like, the lower midfield positions, especially, it was so close. And you saw also at the front that there was the battle going on in the sprint race with Martino Stenson, Lawrence Van Hoopen, later Arvid Lindblad joined in. It was just fascinating. And honestly, I don't think you have that in any other series around the world.
We've got Martino Stenson, P1. Arvid Lindblad, P2, Laurens Van Hoopen, P3 in the sprint race. And yes, you got the caveat that it's a sprint race. But we said before, I'm saying we as in the Feeder Series editors, the Feeder Series group, but also the wider Feeder Series world, of which viewers and listeners, I include you. We did say this is going to be one of the best talent pools in F2 and F3. Michael, you're the F3, or the closest to an F3 editor we've got right now, with Daniele unfortunately unavailable. Is the fact we had 3 rookies taking on the podium in the sprint race just showing how deep the talent goes in F3 for this year?
You could say so, but I think also the sprint race is always going to draw from that group that's kind of, you know, the P8 to P12 in qualifying. And those are the people who, you know, as rookies, it's impressive. But if you want to be a standout rookie, you've already got to be at that level in your first year. So I think it does. I think where, you know, you see this talent depth is in going further down the field. You've got some really impressive drivers who in both Bahrain and Melbourne have really just not qualified as far up as you'd expect them to. You know, Joseph Loke, P29, granted he had the accident, but, you know, someone that coming off this Aston Martin test, you know, third in GB3, I think would be a bit higher up than that.
Can I just interrupt quickly and just give Joseph Loke a little round of applause to say, when you crash, get off the, like, don't ruin everyone else's lap. I know it comes down to how much damage you do to the car, but what a champion he was for continuing on down the pit straight and qualifying. That was, I was thinking this is going to be a red flag and screwed everyone else's time. So it kind of fell on his sword a little bit because he might have qualified a little bit higher, but sorry to interrupt you. I just was mighty impressed with that.
I mean, he still improved his best time. And I have a note in the document where I was taking notes of, like, I can't believe that actually happened. So I know Daniela had a good laugh at that. But yeah, I mean, other drivers that you'd expect further up, Santiago Ramos, P18, this weekend in qualifying, Tim Tramnitz, P22. You'd think those drivers, you know, of course it's the ebb and flow of the grid, but the fact that people who are coming in with, you know, quite solid reputations, or in the case of Ramos, you know, not only a solid Freca reputation, but also in one of the fastest cars on the grid historically, being that far down is, I think, indicative of the fact we've got, you know, people cycling in now. And of course, shout out also to those that were on the periphery. Joshua Dufek, P13, honestly, not somebody I expected to be that far up. Bedrin, P4 in that PHM, look at where they were last year. Barely taking, I mean, Flourish got 6 points. That was all that team scored. I know they've got more investment now. I know Bedrin's, you know, properly experienced at this point, but those are the surprising ones. So we've seen, I think, not just in where these rookies are ending up, and, you know, a shout out to Lindblad and Van Hopen for, I think, exceeding what some people might have expected of them. Lindblad with the victory, Van Hopen with two podiums.
And shout out to friend of the podcast, Charlie Wirtz, as well. P5,
yeah,
feature race.
Brilliant run in the feature race for him. You know, breaking away again from, you know, the Campos drivers who are coming in with a lot more experience than he's got. Vors is someone that really has impressed me in Macau. You saw that pace. He was up in P6 before, you know, Paul Aaron's accident and the aftermath of that. And someone that I think, again, you can't discount him. You can't discount Max Esterson, who was quite impressive as well in Bahrain. So just the way that we've got these surprises that, in the grand scheme of things, it's not that much of a surprise that they're doing as well as they are, because we've got a really close grid in that midfield. That front four right now do appear a bit in a league of their own, but all the way from P5 down to, you know, the mid-20s, it's really anyone's guess who's going to finish where. There's some that are going to be more at the front, some more at the back, but, you know, those people can quite easily, I'd say, luck into, you know, a sprint race, you know, reverse grid pole, which could convert to a win or to a podium, or anything like that. So it's really quite interesting. And I love F3 in that way, because it's a bit of a sieve in a way. You've got all these people coming in from below, but you've got people that, you know, on their day can really shine and break through. And those that, you know, if they can't do it consistently enough, that's where it ends. So it's such a crucial series in that regard too, because of the variety and talents you've got coming in from so many different places, and just seeing who can adapt the best to this F1 package, to the Pirelli tires, as they look to move up into Formula 2 and beyond.
Very well said, Michael. I'm going to have to bring back a little bit and into the F2 side of things, because Martin alluded to the fact that it wasn't a double win weekend, although somebody got the P1 trophy twice. And that was because of an incident at the start line, which, well, we found out after that there was an appeal of sorts coming from Campos and pointing to Imola a couple of years ago, where it didn't have the same penalty applied. Martin, what's your take on this? I don't want to put you too much on the spot, but considering the context of the wider weekend, which Michael and Finio can comment on in a moment, it wasn't a good look.
So I'm, in terms of whether it should have been a 10-second penalty, I'm going to kind of almost sit on the fence a bit. I think it was Hajar's fault. I think that much is clear, because, you know, he came across and it hit Martin and Bartoletto. But at the same time, I really don't think that merits a 10-second penalty. I know that the stewards have been harsher this year in terms of giving out penalties for incidents that they think should have a penalty, with, I think, Luke Browning getting a 10-second penalty in Bahrain for forcing someone off the track in F3. But I don't even think Hajar's driving really warranted a penalty. I think it could have been dealt with a reprimand or a fine if you felt the need to punish it. But I just don't think that an incident like that at the start of a race is something that that can be given a 10-second penalty for. Otherwise, how are drivers going to cover each other off when they're not going to be able to have a 360-degree vision, all sides around them? So I think it's a difficult one for Campos to take. I can see why the stewards have made that decision, because at the end of the day, it was Hadjar's fault. He was the cause of the accident. But I still think at the start of a race, I don't think you can start giving out 10-second penalties for that kind of incident, because then what kind of precedent does that set? So I would maybe not agree with Campos's strongly worded Instagram post, but I certainly think that the penalty maybe was a bit harsh on Hadjar, even if the incident was maybe his fault.
Would you say it's equivalent to a slight nudge going down the DRS straight into the back of Ollie Bearman for another Campos, who also got a 10-second penalty for not ruining somebody else's race, which really struck me when I watched the feature race?
It's so strange, because on some occasions, the stewards are really, really heavy-handed with these penalties. And on some occasions, you think, well, why has that not got a penalty at all? He clearly forced him off the track, or it was clearly the collision was clearly his fault. And I think, especially with the Hadjar one, often you talk about drivers in all series not getting penalties because it's a lap one incident and because cars are everywhere. And with the Marty and Bearman incident, again, I'm not sure how that represented a 10-second penalty. And there was also the Stanek and O'Sullivan incident, which was another lap one call. And I think inconsistency maybe is the issue, because maybe, of course, it's consistent. They're all getting 10-second penalties, but these incidents are totally different.
Mm. I am going to just slightly skip over you, Michael, because I know you will have strong views about the next subject, and I'm going to put Finio again in the hot seat rather than hot speak. Let's stick on F2 for a moment, Finio. Your take on the Hadjar, which became the talking point a little bit about he lost the win, got the win eventually by a bit of fortune, which might be karma coming his way. But if you were the stewards, is 10 seconds a little bit harsh?
It is. My opinion of, actually, I would say it wasn't even Hatcher's fault. It was rather a racing incident. As Martin said, you don't have the overview as a driver. And especially, personally, I mean, it's kind of difficult to say, but personally, I think this is the definition of a racing incident, especially those starts where you try to make up as much ground as you can. You try to, go for every gap that you find, and incidents like these happen. It's unfortunate. It looks kind of heavy in the end. The incident or the accident, the impact in the end looked quite hard for both drivers. So I think that was kind of the difficult thing. But I think it doesn't really, I can't see a reason why a 10-second penalty would be fair for Hadjar there.
I am going to just put a pin on that, because I think Bortoleto, Chris McCarthy said, had never had a DNF in like years or something in commentary. And now he is on a run of three retirements in a row, which is astonishing, which again, he had nowhere to go in the sprint race. But I wanted to bring that up because I was staggered when I noticed that. But I'm going to also put you on the spot, Finio, and get back picking that pin out and say there was an incident on Friday to kick off the feeder series weekend, which I know because I've read a decently written op-ed with some not sitting on the fence opinions by one of our editors, Michael McClaw. But Finio, if you were the stewards for an incident on Friday in practice with Solov and Dunn, would you just think a 3-place grid penalty is the right call?
No, honestly, if I was a steward that weekend, Solov would have not raced that weekend. He would have not even have taken participated qualifying later that day. What he did there was totally, I'm sorry to be straightforward there, but it was stupid. I mean, if you want to show him your opinion and weave over to the other side of the track, okay. But with as much experience as you have as a second year driver in Formula 3, you shouldn't be involved in an incident like this. And honestly, I think to put this in comparison to the 10-second time penalty that Hatcher got in Dev 2, which in the end is quite a hard penalty. And then you see you get a 3-place grid penalty for perhaps even taking someone out on purpose, although it's just practice, of course, but there's a risk that the other driver is not participating in qualifying later that day. I think it's just, inconsistent of the stewards again. Of course, I'm pretty sure it weren't the same stewards, DF2 and F3 stewards, but still this just shows that something, probably wasn't 100% right there.
Yeah, I'm giving you quite difficult questions to answer here, Fidja. So as making your debut on the podcast, I do apologize for that. But it's also to preface a little bit, because let me pull back the veil a little bit of Feeder Series. We have a little joke within our editor group chat, our staff group chat, about Read More Michael, who can occasionally send a message which is verbose, that we have to do a read more on WhatsApp because it's more than a few hundred characters. And I love them. Michael is a very, he's the most articulate person we've got. With no offense to anybody else, because I don't think you could argue it. And even just explaining why the F3 talent pool is like a sieve is exemplifies my statement. But I am going to rest back a little bit, because two things, Michael. You wrote the op-ed, and I know you've got some other thoughts that you want to add to it. But also, you and I were in communications, which I alluded to, about our other F2 editor, Stephen, who was on the ground with regards to the whole incident. And I really think it's a pat on the back instance of Feeder Series for Stephen for everything that happened. And I'm just going to say the floor is yours. How do you want to talk about this potentially very dangerous incident that happened in practice on Formula 3?
I think I will begin where you left off and mention Stephen's conversation with Nikola Tsolov about maybe 20 minutes after practice ended. And first of all, I've been in the paddock quite a few times, as some of you know, watching this. Being there as a first timer is not an easy task. Going in there, not necessarily knowing the drivers, but seeing them on the press conferences and making that transition is quite difficult. And Stephen, immediately did this. So first of all, kudos to him for getting really, insightful quotes from Nikola Tsolov right after the incident. And from Tsolov, in being candid to share what he thought of the incident, which, as we'll later see, was somewhat contradicted by what came out in the stewards' ruling. And a bit on that, I wrote in the op-ed that came out on Saturday morning, right before the F3 sprint race, that I thought it was a sobering case of what happened. I think it illustrates the decision, a lot of the problems we've got now in the world of junior single-seaters, which is that we have lost the purpose of what these series are meant to be. This is fundamentally a schoolyard for the children, in a way. We've got kids who are coming in there, they are sacrificing their education, they are putting potential career prospects on hold. And I think, the three of us in this call are all around F3 driver age, if I can say this. I'm 22. I've got drivers who are older and younger than me in these series.
I'm 18,
they are making the very significant, very costly decision to put, if not their entire education's on hold, at least, go to some sort of homeschool system where they might not be learning as much how to interact with others. They might not be getting the same kind of instruction that you might get in a traditional setting. And instead, they go to the paddock, which is really the place where they learn all these things. They learn how to manage conflict. They learn how to excel. They learn about the importance of hard work, of respect, of responsibility and accountability. And we can argue what we want about whether Tsolov displayed those characteristics. I think it's fairly easy to say that at least a couple of those were violated in what happened with Alex Dunn. But what concerns me is the fact that the stewards did not see the value of this. They seemingly took what was, very best, a controversial, questionable maneuver and really downplayed it. If you look at the season at the end, it's going to be a footnote. It's not on the standings reflected in any way that this happened. No one who's going to look at that Wikipedia page is going to know that anything happened in that practice session. And it's not just about what we as the outsider see. It's about what the drivers themselves see and learn from this. If you're watching that session, and you're, you know, a 13-year-old kid in karting, an 8-year-old who's just done their first testing session in a kart somewhere, or, you know, a gentleman driver who's maybe in their 40s but watches F3 for fun and goes and races the next weekend. If they see this as the drivers who are coming up to make it professional and they see that they can get away with this, it's not the right message to send. It tells them that it is okay to, you know, send someone off or, you know, to react in a moment of anger and cut across on your rival. And whether or not the contact was intentional, still to put them in danger because, well, I think I was wronged and I want to make that right. It's not Tolov's job to do that. It's the steward's job to do that. And they didn't do that. But I want to touch on another point too, because the anger is something that I think we've seen speculated as a reason for this. And I asked the F3 drivers, there was a conversation in the press conference on Friday after qualifying about this. So it was Leo Fornaroli, Dino Boganovic, and Gabriele Mini. And I was really taken aback by the eloquence of their answers. I'm going to read a little bit about it from here. So Leo Fornaroli talked about, my family's always there to support me, his physical trainer. We always try a lot to stay as focused as possible, and without the struggling mind, trying to stay as cool as possible. And that's one answer. Another one, Gabriele Mini talks about working with Formula Medicine, going there to train. On the mental side, though, he says a lot of that work happens outside the track and not when you're at the track. At the circuit, you're in this bubble and you're just too wrapped up in what's going on in the racing. With Boganovic, you know, I'm going to pull out his quote because I think he really said it beautifully here. We're working very closely on the mental side because it's a big aspect in our sport, but also in every other sport. And in daily life, it can affect a lot. It can be your biggest friend, but also the biggest rival. And what we saw here with Solov was a very problematic on-track incident. But I believe that so much of this stems from what is going on in the mind as a driver. If your approach to this is to react in such a way, that's the sign of, you know, an approach, a mindset that's not healthy. And without advocating a particular penalty, Solov getting a slap on the wrist and being able to continue qualifying does not give him the chance to learn from that, to think about it. And, you know, to get that kind of mental counseling, he might need to not repeat that incident, or any other driver. What we've got are drivers who are openly saying the importance of mental well-being, whether or not they work with a psychologist, how open they are about, you know, what they're going through. It's clear that they see the value of it. And why are you as adults in the stewarding room throwing that chance away, you know, disregarding the importance of this? And another point here, you know, Solov's in an academy, an F1 academy. Shouldn't they be coming in to support him? I'm sure they are. I'm sure Alpine's got people. I know some of the Alpine trainers who are around and supporting him. But again, you can't really do this at the racetrack if you're busy. What I think, if you're looking at this from the outside view, what is best for Nikola Solov, who, mind you, is 17, it is not to get him back in the car that weekend. It's to pull him out and to make sure, you know, is everything all right? Genuinely, why would somebody do something like this? And if that's the way he reacts, how can we fix this? He should be taking the time to reflect. He should be doing this away from the spotlight. Right now, we've ended up in the very sad situation that the spotlight has come back on this, not because of what he's necessarily done, but because of how those in charge have reacted to it. And it's going to impede his, you know, growth and development further, because we've just got everyone's hammering on about this penalty. You know, I'm hammering on about it. I'm upset about what happened, but I'm more upset about how they reacted to it. And he should be away from the track, whether he's racing or not. Okay, there's an absence that he's not there, but if he's going to be on track again, it's quite conspicuous. And if, you know, if he does the same thing again, well, who knows? I mean, that's really the worst outcome we've got here. So he should be away from the spotlight and doing this in a place where, you know, he can think about this, practicing maybe on the simulator. You know, I know he's on iRacing. I know other drivers are always on iRacing. On iRacing, don't, you know, react that way. I'm sure, you know, many of the drivers won't behave like that, but that's your laboratory where you're driving against other people. Put yourself in situations where you are able to do that and where you can learn, not where you have to go out and make these mistakes in the real world and not get the chance to learn from them, because those in charge not only tell you functionally that it's okay, but also take away the opportunity to learn from it. I think that's the saddest part about this. It's not what happened on track. We've all seen that. We all know the problems inherent to what he did. And we all know what could have been the consequence. Dunn's accident was sizable. It was not as bad as it could have been, but we don't want to speculate about how bad it could have gone. But the fact that this could happen again, the fact that something like this could be, you know, seen as, well, it's okay to react in this way. It's a precedent I don't want to see set. It's not why I tune into racing. As I wrote at the very end of my piece, I and many, many others who are in these paddocks are here because we want to see skill and bravery, not because we want to relive accidents or worse, to see cowardice and potential malintent not only let off, but even potentially glorified and rewarded at the very extreme case of this. So I'm upset about this, but it goes beyond what happened on Friday.
I am not going to continue on this, Michael, because I don't think I or anyone on the podcast could say it more eloquently than you did. It's something we don't want to see again. I think that's where we're going to put it in. We're going to have to put a stop to it. But very well said, Michael. Very well said. Finyo, you have the glorious task of turning this into some positivity with something that is called Super Formula. And a guy called Théo Pourchaire made his debut, which I know some F2 people might have heard about. But he's the only non-Japanese driver in Super Formula this year, which I will admit, I have always wanted to watch more of it, and I watched a little bit last year, kind of spurred on by the Liam Lawson interest, and then I don't know if I expected Pourchaire to follow in the footsteps and be an immediate championship challenger. I know things are very, very different for him. But wow, let's use him as a segue to go in there as an introductory point. What can you tell us about Super Formula this year? What can you tell us is not just about Théo Pourchaire? And yeah, your thoughts on the opening round, which happened a week or two ago.
I'd like to start at pre-season testing, because we've had, or actually post-season testing in 2023, because we had international drivers who were participating in those tests. There was Roel Heimann in the pre-season test this year. And among others, it was also Rasmus Lind in the postseason test in 2023. Rasmus Lind, interestingly, he was expected to race with TGM for this year. He confirmed to me that the sponsor backed out last minute, and that was the reason why he couldn't sign with TGM. So in the end, TGM decided to sign Nobuharu Matsushita. We ended up with just one international driver on the grid, which is quite interesting. But yeah, going into Suzuka, the first round, I think there were quite high expectations, especially for the two F2 alumni. If you're a Formula 2 champion, I think everyone expects you to be up there. And I think it came as quite a big surprise to see him just in 17th, I think he qualified. No, 16th, sorry. Which is kind of a shock. It must be said, I think a lot of people compare Théo Pourchaire, and probably Ayumu Iwasa as well, to Liam Lawson last year, who made the switch to Super Formula. Personally, I think you cannot compare at least Pourchaire to Lawson, because they're racing for different teams, and that actually makes quite a big difference. So let's talk about the race. Theo had, quite a difficult race. First of all, he's had quite a difficult start, lost a couple of positions there. Wasn't easy from the beginning. Then there was an incident in the opening laps, and after the safety car restart, Theo got stuck behind a group of cars and couldn't go past. So I think compared to Formula 2, Super Formula is a bit different. It's probably just a different challenge. I wouldn't particularly say it's a more difficult challenge. It's rather a different challenge, and I think it's something that he needs to get used to. And then I think, which is something that's already well known, he had this incident later in the race at turn 7, where he even lost his wing. He went off track, spun off the track, and hit the barrier. Interestingly, he told us that he tried to go flat out through that corner, which is kind of interesting given the track temperature and air temperature we had that weekend. We had 13 degrees Celsius track temperature and 9 degrees air temperature, which is...
In Formula Winter Series, I mean, that doesn't...
Exactly, you'd expect that over there, but not in Super Formula. And this is unconfirmed, but I've been told that there was even snowfall from Saturday to Sunday in Suzuka, which is kind of crazy. I mean, I can't remember a Formula One race or any other feeder series race that happened when we had such bad conditions.
No.
Can you?
I know we had some testing, pre-season testing in F1 a few years ago, which I think had a bit of snow, and maybe a couple of Red Bull marketing videos with snow, but a race. No, that is crazy.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, okay. Well, that's it on Porsche. I think personally, he just needs to get used to the new car. It's kind of difficult. But as a rookie, or especially as an international rookie, and that also kind of counts for Ayumi Iwasa, I'll explain why, is the fact that, you know, he doesn't face other talented young drivers that aim to be in Formula One, but now Porsche this year actually faces drivers who race on those Japanese circuits for years, if not decades, which is kind of a new challenge. You actually face drivers that race on those circuits for so many years, they know every inch of the circuit, and you know, to beat them is actually quite impressive. And we've seen it last year with Lawson, of course, who did a phenomenal job, and it was on the same level as his teammate Tomoki Nojiri, who won 2 championships in the series already. That was quite impressive. But now for Ayumi Iwasa, who takes the spot of Liam Lawson at Mugen for this year, we still cannot expect him to do as well as Lawson did, you know. Lawson's job, I mean, I think this year will show that Lawson's performance was mightily impressive last year. Iwasa, now here in Super Formula, he started in P11. He qualified in 11th, which is quite okay for your debut round. He qualified as best rookie. There are 2 more rookies among Iwasa and Porsche. And also he had quite an eventful race, a couple of overtakes, and in the end finished in P9, which is quite okay for a rookie, I'd say. But again, he's facing drivers who race on those circuits for years, and I think this is a new challenge that you don't have in Formula 2 or any other feeder series.
Apart from there's some guy called Richard Vachon or Ralph Boschong, but I get your point.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Though Nojiri won the race in Suzuka, from what I saw. Nojiri, you were saying, Liam Lawson's teammate. So is Nojiri the favourite for the championship this year? I know he's obviously came in, as you say, double champion before. Is it as clear cut as that am I right in saying he's a top returning driver?
He is the top returning driver. That is correct, because champion Ritomo Miyata went to F2, and Liam Lawson obviously is now at Red Bull and their sister team with
in hell watching Daniel Ricciardo driving the car that he should be driving. Yeah. I understand. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Nojiri is the top returning driver, and personally, also my favorite for the championship. I expected Shio Tsuboi to be up there. He's racing with Toms, and now made the switch to the team that Ritomo Miyata won the championship with last year. I expect him to be up there, but he didn't even finish inside the top 10 here in Suzuka. So we'll see how it goes.
I do intend to watch more Super Formula this year, but I'm going to be honest and say, I know I really should. I feel embarrassed. But at this present moment, the last 36 hours, I've watched 8 races because I was at MotoGP as well with Moto2 and Moto3. Plus, I see nodding around as got F2. Oh, it's been a lot, guys. It's been a lot. But I was at Portimao, which was where MotoGP was. And I do apologize, Feeder Series fans, for listening to me talk about two-wheel sports, because that's not how
Don't
we are. But
apologize.
There is...
We can enjoy both.
There is a purpose for me saying it, though, because there was a championship there a couple of months ago called Formula Winter Series, which didn't have any formula there because there was the LMP and GT racing, but they didn't have any formula cars there. That all changed, though, because Formula Winter Series turned into I think there was 400 or some ridiculous amount of entries, right, into this championship. Huge interest in it. That ended up with 38 odd, like a lot of cars. I was fortunate to see some of it in Jerez. And then I know, Finho, you went to Barcelona. Yes, Barcelona. Yes. Where you were doing it. I was going a little bit as a fan, with a little bit for another client. You did it as a feeder series editor to go and cover this. How was your experience, and what learnings can you give us from your time in Barcelona?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was an amazing 2 days. My first time doing journalism in person, actually, which is kind of cool. Well, the Saturday, you probably saw it was wet, extremely wet. We had extreme conditions.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. And in the end, we did not even have a green flag running, which is a shame. But for me personally, from a journalistic perspective, it was kind of cool to catch up with all the chaos going on. So that was kind of interesting. But yeah, we had a championship fight going into the final round of the season. It was scheduled to be 3 races. In the end, it turned out to be 2 races due to the weather chaos. Griffin Peebles and Andrés Cárdenas went into the final races of the season, just with a few points separating the two. I think it was 5 points, if I'm not mistaken. And there were other drivers in mathematical contention as well. But honestly, it was clear that they would really have to deliver.
Sergio Perez is sometimes in mathematical contention for the championship, but you know, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, never count them out, you know. You never know what happens, but I think the focus was really on Peebles versus Cárdenas. So on Sunday morning, we had the first time that we had green flag running, and it started with the second qualifying session, which sets the grid for the third race, and because of the weather conditions, it also set the race the grid for the second race, with the second best lap time set in the session. Griffin Peebles got pole position for the second race, started from first, and I think Andrés Cárdenas, if I remember correctly, started from fifth. And Griffin Peebles had the chance to win the championship in that race, actually, if he outscored Andrés Cárdenas by 20 points in that race. He didn't. It was quite an interesting race, actually. Andrés Cárdenas in the end finished on the podium as well. And we went into the final race of the season with the championship yet to be decided. It was extremely interesting to cover that, and in the end, Griffin Peebles won. Personally, I say it was deserved. It was extremely consistent on that weekend, and I think, a promising start for the future.
Yeah, I saw him win myself, actually, in Jerez, and then actually had him sitting behind me. Just incidentally, I didn't actually get a chance to speak to him. I wish I did now, but sitting behind me in the canteen as well, which is quite fun with his family. So always nice to see the families. I was watching from a UFO. I don't know what it is in Jerez, the thing above the start-finish line, and the Block family were there. And you always forget. I mean, there were 38-ish drivers in there in any single weekend. And then behind them, there is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 family members all there to support. It's such an involved thing when you get to the feeder series. That's one of the big takeaways I think I've had from the paddock, that it's a family event. There's so much involved in it. I'm glad for you got the chance to do it, and I know it won't be the last time. Formula Winter Series growing in prestige. We've got Chris McCarthy, obviously Transfer Weekly host and F3 commentator, and Feeder Series broadcast team. I'm not going to say friend of the podcast now. Chris is one of us, covering it too. So a great championship. I really look forward to seeing how it grows next year, because I think already it's become like F4 UAE Formula Winter Series. It's become one of these, like TRS, it's one of those championships for the winter, which is really nice. I'm going to go into the hot takes, which we asked the Feeder Series audience on X, Twitter, X, whichever one it is, what they thought on the F2 and F3 weekend. And I'm going to say this one to you, Martin, as an F2 editor, that some guy called Jordi van der Bunt said the F3 sprint is an early contender for race of the year. You have to be independent because you're not an F2, you're an F2 editor in this, so F3, it's not your bag. So yay or nay?
I would go with yay. I thought it was a really good race. I think we've had some other very, very good feeder series races so far this year, but you know, I think there were good battles all the way up and down the field. There were a couple of incidents. You know, it was a really unfortunate weekend forward to Sanibel Intrapuvisat. But I think on the whole, for everyone, I think it was the race of the year. I think, to be honest, all weekend, like we alluded to earlier, I think Melbourne and feeder series, I think it's been a really positive move. I know there was some discussions when it first came in that it was going to be a really expensive one for the teams and participants. But I do think it's, in terms of the racing perspective, been a really good move.
The cost.
Yeah, must be. I think it's been a really good move because all weekend and last year in F2 as well, I think we've had some really good racing across the series. So, I would agree with that from Mr. Geordie Vanderbunt.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Geordie Vanderbunt. Wes Manbridge also is going to say, is agreeing with us, sorry, because Wes said that the F3 sprint may as well have been the best feeder series race in the last 10 years. So another hot take there. there are some, Michael, which I'm going to throw all over onto you because it's, I don't know, there's a tie to your monologue. I'm going to say Finio that we had. Alice Grace Cook, Franco Colapinto deserves better. Is there something you agree with?
I totally do. If I remember correctly, he got disqualified, right?
Yeah, some incorrect starting procedure.
Yeah, I don't know. I think those kind of penalties are always harsh. I mean, especially for you as a driver. It's unlucky in the end. And Franco, I think he's been very unlucky so far in Formula 2, right?
Yeah, just unlucky in Australia as well. I don't want to bring it up. I'm going to bring you this one to you, Delfinio. Ranks 9. Enjoying F2 way more than F1. Every single race is a banger. Agree?
Yeah, I would. I mean, F2 never disappointed me since I started watching in 2020, I think. Mm-hmm. We always had very close racing. We never had, like, someone running away with the championship. Maybe in 2022 we had Felipe Drugovich rather dominating it, but it wasn't like that he was unstoppable. I mean, I wouldn't say that it was clear ahead of the season that he would just run away with it. And especially for this year, I think we have a very interesting situation where we have so many drivers that are, well, let's say that have the talent and the pace to win races and perhaps even win the championship. And we got the new cars, which seem to be quite good for racing. So I really enjoy F2 at the moment as well, yeah.
Yeah, suiting a certain Paul Aaron, suiting a certain Zane Maloney. Yeah. They are changing things a lot. This guy is called Stian Solom Karlberg. Saturday great, Sunday gutted, Norwegian flag. And then we've got GGMU Warrior. Pretty painful and joyful weekend as a Hauger fan. Martin, your thoughts on these poor Norwegians?
Yeah, I think it was a really up and down weekend for Hauger, of course. Getting the pole position and going for another podium. And I didn't know if he was going to win the race, but I certainly thought he was pretty nailed on for a podium unless there was some unlucky strategy in there. But then, of course, the camera pans to turn 6, which has caused so many drivers in all different series an absolute disaster this weekend.
Logan Sargeant at that corner was just woeful, wasn't it?
It was, I mean, you could see the number 2 on the car at least. Might have been a 3 as well. I think I do feel a little sorry for Hauger. I know Alex Brundle said on commentary that it seemed that there may have been a car issue, and it did seem a little unlike Hauger to just drop the car like that. Mm. But I do think, although maybe it feels a little bit raw now for those Norwegian fans, I do think that they'll come out of this weekend and realise that actually it is his third year, and I don't know if Formula One is realistic anymore, but Hauger, I would say, is an early, early, early contender for this championship alongside a couple of others.
Well, I was asking for the hot takes from the pundits here, but that is a hot take as well. I like that. I'm going to just go through some of these ones just to bring them up, because I think they're good. There's Cat 3, Journal of Cat is the account name. As a Ollie, fan, I think, as an Ollie fan, just happy he got points in the end of the race weekend. And as a Dino, Arvid and Paul fan, really happy. Paul is an absolute incredible F2 rookie. Take that, Al Mercedes. I totally get what you're saying there. I am G014, better races than F1, as always. Yuki Astris, I was just here for Dino P1. Yeah, I get that. And then this is going to come to you, Michael. You're going to handle these last few. But the way it goes in was a bit of a poem, because we've got Aslan Pacheco, F3 great races, F2 good races, and then V4 L3 Valen. After that said, FIA needs changes, which rhymed really well, which then goes into honest F1. Stewards were very awful and very slow. F2 was a banger, but F3 was boring. I'm not sure if I agree on the last one. Skeptical meme zero, or George 2.0. Great racing, but hurt by the stewards making really questionable decisions. And then going up, Matt Tucson, great racing, corrupt stewarding, Magic 14 Nano, really poor standards from stewards giving penalties. The fact that Solov was allowed to race is embarrassing. Michael, there's some hot takes which seem to lay a little bit of foundation for your thoughts, which I think suggests that you're not alone in what you were saying.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the reaction to the things I wrote, partly was, you know, preempted by what I saw online, which was general agreement with the fact that something wasn't handled correctly. I wanted to touch on a couple more things, somewhat disconnected from, you know, my earlier polemic that, first of all, there's always questions about how is the steward inconsistent from round to round, from race to race. We know it's a fundamentally human endeavor, as if, you know, if you're in any court, if you're in any kind of legal system, there's always going to be a different jury. You're going to have different judges. You're going to have different lawyers arguing different cases. And what's going on here is kind of the micro level version of that. It's a highly televised one. There's always the question, do we want to have a consistent stewarding board across the year for the series, or across, you know, an entire weekend from F1, F2, F3? I think this weekend is potentially supported an argument in favor of that in some way, because we saw, you know, wide variation in how things were handled. The F2 stewards were a lot less forgiving about things. The F3 stewards seemed very forgiving about this, and perhaps less so in other matters. And the F1 stewards as well, with the Alonso 20-second penalty for the, you know, the last lap penultimate lap thing with Russell, is again, you know, has been a point of contention online. Was that fair? Was what Alonso did in any way deliberate? Was the penalty correct? And if you look at all of these together, you could maybe come to a more coherent understanding of why certain things get the penalties they do and why they don't. I compare it in my piece to what happened last year, the penalties that got, you know, three grid drop, two penalty points. It was impeding another driver, which is exactly what Alex Dunn was slapped on the wrist for before Solov went and swerved in front of him. There was a yellow flag infringement crossing the white line at pit entry, at pit exit. And so, you know, those are all minor safety things, but I don't think those are quite at the level of seriousness as the other thing, because there isn't another car at racing speed that's involved. I wanted to touch on one last thing here, that I think some of the debate about this has veered beyond a point of reasonable, and it's gotten into attacks on drivers, attacks on Nicholas Solov in particular. And as I mentioned earlier, yes, he's 17, you know, he's young, he's going to make mistakes, but we can't just go out there and look at an error and take that to be wholly and entirely representative of somebody's character or of their worth. What we saw was a huge lapse in judgment. You know, that's maybe the most, you know, positive spin on this we can put. But does that necessarily mean that Solov, you know, is a horrible human being, or some of the, you know, more outlandish takes or, you know, deserving of really nasty criticism? I think we have to remember that this is fundamentally about a decision and not a person. This criticism is not personal, and I don't think, you know, I hope nobody would be taking this any differently were it another driver involved. And again, I think that's what makes this sad, is that by not punishing the action appropriately, they've allowed for, you know, more things to, they've allowed for more of this discourse to become about people. And that's not the position that you want to put somebody who's 17, probably very impressionable, as many people that age are, and, you know, on a highly televised sport, in. You don't want to leave them vulnerable to that kind of thing. So the attitude that I get from this is a little bit one of coddling. But what I think needs to be happening here is that we need to be punishing the actions harshly. I'm, you know, I would say generally those punishments that came up earlier, I'm maybe more in favor of them, because I think that, you know, we want to see good racing. We don't want to see incidents, and, you know, giving a slap on the wrist for a mistake, whether intentional or entirely accidental, I think is fair. People make mistakes, and, you know, you punish and you learn from them, and you don't do them again, and you become, you know, better at your job or better in other ways as a result of that. And now we've got this attitude where that's not punished. And so, okay, the way that we want to support drivers, which is what fundamentally this should be about, is essentially by coddling them and, you know, sort of telling them, yeah, it's okay. You know, just a little slap on the wrist and, you know, you're fine. You can move on. And I know it's representative of the way that, frankly, a lot of society has gone now. You know, you can look at, you know, I went through the college process a couple of years ago, and that was something I observed, was I think that, you know, the way that people are being treated is a lot more of a kinder approach that is in some ways good, but it doesn't allow people to properly reflect on things and, you know, make those difficult moves of having to grow as a person. And that's what you need at this age. So I think that's, you know, another learning from this is I think we've, not only have we potentially risked losing our way as a sport on track, but we've lost the purpose of making this, you know, a place for growth. And again, you know, we can talk all we want about corruption. I don't think there's anything corrupt in this. I think it's simply a difference in attitude, and one that I don't agree with, and one that I think, if you look at it from a broad point of view, is not the right stance to be taking towards this entire sport. It's entertainment, but it's also a place for them where they need to learn, so that when they do go on to do this professionally, they aren't making the mistakes that could cost them their job, cost them their salary, cost them their career, get them in criminal trouble, etc. Because we all know that as an adult, you're not going to get the same kind of treatment you might when you're younger.
Very measured, Michael. It's a way that you've got with words, which I it's why people should read your op-ed on feederseries.net, absolutely. And I think you've got a point just with regards to everybody's favorite ex-feeder series driver, or feeder series, depending on how you look at it. I'm going to make some people upset by saying that. Dan Ticktum, who turned into a brilliant piece for listening on the radio, but wow, did he have to learn his lesson the hard way, and he learned his lesson. So I think let's leave it there, because I'm going to say that's all the time. I've gone very long on this, way longer than I intended, but oh, man, we've got to read more Michael with us, but also we had some great racing as well. So I'm going to allow it. So thank you, Martin. Thank you, Finya. Thank you, Michael. Thank you to everybody for watching and listening. If you're watching on YouTube, please drop a like on the video, leave a comment, and subscribe to the channel. All of that really helps us out. And if you're listening, leave a review on the podcast platform you're listening on. We greatly appreciate it. Finally, check out feederseries.net for more Feeder Series insight, and follow feeder_series and FS Americas on X, Twitter, whatever we're going to call it. And on Instagram, which we know what that's called, Feeder Series Net is the account on that. You can find the links to everything there, plus where to find everyone else in this episode in the YouTube description or in the podcast show notes. Until next time, we have been the Feeder Series Podcast. Goodbye.